Okay, so thank you for the invitation. Now Kevin's heard most of this, so he's going to have to suffer through it. So what I thought I would do is talk about some of our recent work in protein design. And the design work in my lab combines both computational and experimental things. And so I'll go through an abbreviated introduction, and we'll be happy to stop at any time and elaborate on some of the more technical details. And then I have, I think, three, one very quick experimental result, and then three separate projects, which I'll try to go through. But I want to make sure that we end up on the last project, which is a very new result, and that is the design of an enzyme. Using computational techniques and then manifesting that design in the laboratory and actually showing that it works properly. So I ran into David Baker yesterday. He was in Pasadena. Apparently he was here on Wednesday, and he said he had a lot of fun and that people interrupted a lot, and his talk took 2 hours. So I'm prepared. Even though I'm just getting over a cold, I think I'll be able to hold out for a couple of hours. Okay, so let me start by making, at least attempting to make a case for protein design as a way to go forward. So when we think about protein design, we think about several different reasons why this might be an interesting thing to do. The first is that we can think of it as really a proactive paradigm for addressing complex issues in structural biology. And what I mean by that is, if you look at how most biology is done today, it's most investigations are done using, experimentally, are done using a mutagenic paradigm. That is, you have some complex system, you make a mutation in a protein or in a gene, and then you make some evaluation experimentally as to what happens to that, what that mutation does, and you try to infer some structure-function relationship. Our belief is that as these biological systems get more and more complex in terms of the things that you're trying to address experimentally, that a better way to go is to use a design paradigm where you're trying to address the full complexity of the system at a computational level and then manifest that experimentally. And I think, in my opinion, a good example of that sort of work was published last year. It was a collaboration between my lab and Tim Springer's lab at Harvard Med School. And in this particular case, we were interested in looking at or addressing the relevance, the experimental or the in vivo relevance of a conformational change in an integrin I domain. And there were two crystal structures, each of which showed a different conformational state. And there was a hypothesis which was one of the states was actually active and the other was inactive. And what we were able to do was to take the structure of the putative active state and by computational design generate a multifold mutant, I can't remember how, maybe a 15-fold mutant, that stabilized that particular conformational state, and then do the same for the putative inactive state. And then to make those molecules experimentally, and it was demonstrated that the molecule designed to be locked in the active state was in fact constitutively active in a real biological assay, and the molecule designed to be locked in the inactive state was constitutively inactive. And so I think it's a great example of how you can use a design approach to actually address some very complex issue, that is the relevance of a conformational state for some biological activity. Yes? They have quite significantly different structures, yes. Same sequence, two different structures. Then the structures are roughly the same fold, but the details of the structure are quite different. One has a metal binding site, and which causes a helix to swing over by about 10 angstroms. So the structural rearrangement is quite significant. And that was published last year in Interstructural Biology. Another, I think, reason to do protein design is to address questions of protein folding and protein stability. That is, if you have some quantitative ideas as to why proteins achieve their thermodynamic stability and why they fold to different structures, you might be able to address those quantitative ideas by running design calculations and then building those molecules in the laboratory and testing whether or not those notions actually hold up under rigorous testing. And something that we've become very interested in, and you know, which is I think going to dominate our work going forward, is this idea of using design approaches to study fold function relationships and to study the evolution of protein structure. And what I mean by that is, for example, for the evolution of protein structure, you might imagine that one scenario for evolving different types of protein structure is starting with some protein structure, for example, an all helical protein, and then having a trajectory of amino acid mutations that eventually brings you to some new fold, an all beta fold, for example. And one way to actually address that is to computationally design that amino acid change trajectory and experimentally see if you can evolve the structure from being all helical to all beta. I won't talk about that today, but I will show you an example of the of a fold function problem where we were able to take a molecule, a protein, that has no enzymatic activity for the target activity of interest, and then we were able to design a protoenzyme that actually experimentally manifests the design activity. And by doing that, we're then able to, I think, address issues of the evolution of protein function, because now we can take molecules that have no activity, design nascent activity, and then use in vitro evolution techniques to optimize the function of the molecule. And then ultimately, I think there are some interesting things that one can do in terms of biotechnology, which is, you know, at least from my perspective, is already being explored in several different ways. Okay, so just to kind of make a distinction about what we're doing and what we're not doing, we're primarily interested in inverse folding or protein design as opposed to protein folding. So I'm sure this is kind of redundant now, but you know, if we have a set of sequences and a set of structures, the folding problem is take some sequence in sequence space and make a prediction about what structure it will achieve in structure space. The inverse folding problem or the design problem is essentially exactly the opposite problem. We want to start with some target structure in structure space or some target function, which will imply some target structure, then ask the question, what set of amino acid sequences will give rise to that target structure and function. And obviously, in the inverse direction, this degeneracy is actually very helpful for us because we can start off by thinking about methods that are not necessarily comprehensive, that just kind of put us in some small part of this subspace here, and then expand those methods to fully encompass all sequences that might actually give rise to some target structure and function. Okay, so in our hands, we divide the computational level, divide the design problem into two separate problems. One is backbone design or fold design, and the other is sequence selection. So for backbone design, what I'll tell you about today is our work where we're using backbones taken from the X-ray crystal structure database. We're also working on methods to design backbones de novo just based on, stereochemical considerations. And in addition, we can also look at, backbones that are based on some homology model. But everything I'll talk about today is based on backbones taken from X-ray structures. For sequence selection, we have found it convenient, both computationally and just for other pragmatic reasons, to divide sequence selection into three different areas. Selection of sequences for the hydrophobic core of a protein, we typically only allow nonpolar amino acids in that part of the calculation. Selection of sequences for the surface of a protein, where we typically only allow polar amino acids. And then selection of sequences for these positions that we call the boundary positions, which lie between the buried core and the exposed surface, where we typically allow all amino acids, except glycine and proline, and methionine, typically. So as you'll see in a couple minutes, the potential function that we're using, the force field that we're using, does not have an entropy term in it. And so, the problem with methionine is that it has three dihedral angles in the side chain, which will get fixed if you're in the core or on the boundary. And that entropy loss experimentally manifests itself as a loss in stability. And since we don't handle that entropy loss in our calculation, we just leave it out. And you'll see there are other ways to cheat here, which actually are very useful. Sorry? Well, so for lysine, you know, for the long polar amino acids like lysarge and glue, they typically would be found on the surface, and you would generally expect that they would not lose all their conformational entropy unless they're forming a tight salt bridge or hydrogen bond. This is why, for example, there's still controversy in the field as to whether or not hydrogen bonds and salt bridges between side chains are, in fact, generally stabilizing. Because typically what you have is, you might get a couple kcals of binding energy for the salt bridge or the hydrogen bond, but you're going to lose maybe, you know, an equivalent amount of energy when you fix those side chains in particular conformations. Let me just fix this. Okay, so having said that,
the boundary between the core and the surface is not sharp.
Is not sharp. That's right. It's kind of fuzzy. Now, so we have methods that are, we have quantitative methods for setting these different categories, and I'll talk about that in a couple minutes. Okay, so so we've approached the problem by using this thing we call design automation cycle, which has these four different components. One is a design paradigm that is constructed in a way that it manifests itself as a simple mathematical computational problem for which we can run, software and run simulations. Also in our simulations, we're building in potential functions that we think describe, protein thermodynamics as it relates to protein design. Then out of the simulation, we get a list of amino acid sequences. We can go into the laboratory and build these molecules using standard methodologies, either peptide synthesis or standard PCR techniques. And importantly, we analyze the biophysical properties of the designed molecules in such a way that it allows us to augment how we run our simulations and how we construct our potential functions. And the idea is that we start very simple, we bootstrap some potential function that we think must work, and then we run through this experimental cycle several times and end up with a collection of potentials that should be appropriate for the design problem. Okay, the design paradigm is very straightforward. It's based on this notion of inverse folding, which was really championed by Carl Pabo in the early 80s, and basically just says that if we start with some fixed protein backbone fold shown diagrammatically here, and a collection of amino acid side chain widgets, all we have to do is find some combination of these widgets that satisfies the target fold. And obviously, there are lots of ways to satisfy the target fold. This is why we need some cost function to evaluate the goodness of each of these things, and the cost function should incorporate those notions of protein thermodynamics. Okay. And also, the simple design paradigm leads to a fairly large combinatorial problem. It's kind of the standard example. If we have 100 amino acid protein, we allow 20 amino acids at every position. That leads to roughly 10 to the 130th different sequence combinations, which is actually quite a large number. And I think, although maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been told by some physicists somewhere that the size of the universe in terms of number of particles is roughly like 10 to the 80. So this is a large problem. And obviously, doing a full sequential search is completely intractable. Now, the problem is even worse than this because we would like to be able to do everything at atomic resolution. So we want all of our potential functions to consider explicitly the position of all the atoms in the protein. So in order to do that, we need to use different side chain rotamers. And so recall, a rotamer is just a particular conformational state of an amino acid side chain. So all of our calculations are done in rotamer space. And so for arginine, for example, we have four dihedral angles, in the side chain, there are going to be a large collection of different conformational states for that side chain, all of which have to be considered in this calculation. The problem is actually made most difficult by our desire to compute ground state solutions despite the large combinatorial complexity. And we've put a lot of effort into this this objective, and we're primarily interested in computing ground state solutions because ultimately we'd like to be able to optimize our potential function. And and we feel that you have to know with mathematical exactness what the best solution is given your target backbone, your target rotamer library, and some current potential function. So we would argue that using approximate techniques like a Monte Carlo simulation or a genetic algorithm are not going to be appropriate if your ultimate objective is to optimize a potential function for protein design.
Maybe we'll talk about this, but you think the best in your solar techniques that you have, how often are the predictions right? If you were to then do the non-inverse, the direct problem sign, is that really a ground state structure for that sequence?
So let me say two things. One is, I will show you the results of calculations and then show you what happens if you build a molecule and make them experimentally. We've spent a lot of effort not only working on the computational methodology, but also building the molecules in the laboratory and solving their structures and showing that these things actually work. So you'll see examples of that. What I want to talk about today are examples where we have a paper coming out in J&B soon, which will discuss this a little bit. Examples where we compute a sequence for some target structure, then we make the molecule experimentally, and it folds to some slightly different structure, which is, this is the negative design problem. So we're typically, our calculations typically focus on, positive design, although there are some negative design components in the calculation. And for the most part, we believe that the way we've constructed the calculation, we are getting good correlation between the computed sequence and the real experimentally determined target structure for that design sequence. But there are cases where we clearly miss, and it suggests that we have to do more work on the negative design problem.
How do you determine
So there's only one ground state solution. There's one solution which is the best, given the backbone, the rotamer library, and the potential function. And so we make the best one.
I think the cost function that you construct only produces for you one sequence, one best sequence.
That's right. Yeah. I mean the density of states is actually pretty high. So the next best sequence may only be some trivial amount of energy away. But when we decide to make something, we typically make the sequence that comes out that is the best sequence. And on some occasions, we'll also make a set of less things that are predicted to be less stable than the best sequence to get an idea of the robustness of the potential function and things like that.
In terms of the negative design question, I think of often internal soul bridges and things like that as helping to exclude other, putting very strong constraints on the, and although it may not help in the stability, helping in the specificity problem of this negative design. So you're excluding of all polar residues from the inside of the protein. How much does that make the negative design problem harder?
So I agree that one way to achieve structural specificity is to build in buried polar interactions, and you see that in a lot of proteins. This is something that I have a paper on in my briefcase, which I can show you later. If you look at, it's a collection of different protein structures. What you see is a function of protein size. An increasing number of buried polar interactions. And there are really, I think, two explanations for this. Two possible explanations. One is that the larger the structure is, the greater is the problem of fold specificity, so you need to build in more Berry-polar interactions to help achieve specificity for that target structure. Another possible explanation is that, you know, as you build larger and larger things, your ability to satisfy the H-bond potential of all the backbone amides and carbonyls goes down. And so in order not to destabilize your protein by burying these unsatisfied hydrogen bond donors and acceptors, you have to go in with side chains, polar side chains, and complement them. So in more recent work, we are, in fact, starting to look at the use of polar interactions in the core and at the boundary to achieve fold specificity. What I'll talk about here does not include issues like that. So as I'll describe in a minute, we use a computational method based on the dead end elimination theorem, which guarantees that if you can get the algorithm to converge, it guarantees that you get the ground state solution.
If it
converges. There's no guarantee of convergence, but if it does converge, you're guaranteed that it is the ground state. Okay, so let me just say a little bit about the simulation methods. We can categorize most of these methods into either deterministic techniques or stochastic methods. And there's a paper that came out last year in JNB where we kind of compared and contrast these four different simulation techniques against each other as they relate to protein design. So we've spent a lot of time on dead end elimination, and as you might expect, this paper comes out and says oftenly that dead elimination is the best thing. So there's some bias in here. But in general, for the deterministic methods, I'll describe dead elimination in a second, we can also use a mean field approach, which has been done, and it's deterministic, and you can get answers out of it, but as demonstrated in this recent paper, you get the wrong answer. You know, you get the same answer all the time, and it's very fast, but you get the wrong answer. We've also used Monte Carlo methods and genetic algorithm methods, everything I'll tell you about today is just based on using dead end elimination as a way to get the sequence and confirmation. Okay, now. So for dead elimination and also for the simple implementations of the mean field theory, we have these requirements that are good and bad. So the requirements are that the energy space has to be uncoupled and discrete. And so for our purposes, it means that we have to have a fixed protein backbone and we have to use discrete sidechain rotamers. That is, we cannot allow continuous variation in the sidechain dihedral angles, nor can we allow the backbone to change its shape at any point in the calculation. So dead end elimination requires this. This would be an interesting thing in terms of, you know, just, you know, applied mathematics. Is there a way to do something like dead end elimination which removes this requirement of having to have discrete energy space? The other important issue is that we can use no greater than two body terms in the energy in our potential functions. And in general, that's not a big deal, but it can become a problem for certain types of potentials. So for example, if you want, which we do want, a part of the potential which captures a hydrophobic effect, and we can typically implement that by considering the burial of hydrophobic surface area. And unfortunately, computing hydrophobic surface area burial is not pairwise decomposable. And so we have to come up with approximate methods to make it pairwise decomposable. Buried surface area is essentially a global property. And so also, if you're interested in using a more sophisticated electrostatic model, like Poisson-Boltzmann type model, where you have to compute a dielectric boundary, that boundary is computed based on the surface of the protein, of the target molecule. And so you have to know the surface in order to compute the right electrostatic energies. But of course, that surface can't be known globally. So there are issues with using sophisticated electrostatic models because they're not parallelized decomposable. Okay, so then there are two types of energy terms that we use. One is the interaction energy between an amino acid side chain rotamer and the protein backbone, or the template, as we call it. So this is just, the energy of some rotamer R at position I in the protein. And then we also compute a rotamer-rotamer interaction energy. So this is then between two positions, I and J, for rotamers R at I and S at J. And so with that, we can then write down the dead end elimination theorem. The original theorem is due to a group of Belgian mathematicians. It was published in Nature almost 10 years ago now. The variation that's written here is due to Goldstein, and more recently, in a collaboration with Johan Desmet, we've published an additional variation, which is not shown here, that is actually quite powerful. And we've spent a lot of time, thinking about, ways to make this run fast, and thinking about complementary techniques that allow you to still get a ground state solution even when your algorithm based on dead elimination does not converge to a single solution. And so the idea basically is, I can spend an hour talking about this if anyone's interested. The basic idea is that we're going to ask a question about some particular rotamer R at some side, at some position I in the protein, and we're going to compare its energies to some other selection at the same residue position, some rotamer T, and if this inequality is satisfied, then we can throw R away and never consider it again. So that is, R is said to be dead-ending and can be eliminated. And so as we eliminate a rotamer, we reduce the combinatorial complexity, and if we iterate on this criterion, ultimately, or hopefully, we'll get to the point where there's nothing left to eliminate. There'll be a single rotamer at every position in the protein, and that that will be the ground state solution. The difficulty comes in that you really have to work hard to get this thing to converge, and the way this evaluates actually fairly quickly, but there are higher order versions of this equation. So instead of having a self energy here and a pair energy here, you can write this also with pair energies here and a triple energy here, which obviously is going to be more time consuming to compute. And it turns out that most of the time in the calculation is spent evaluating the pair and triples. And then there are other things, there are other details which are really important, which I could spend hours talking about.
In this case, so given the given sequence, how many steps do you need to take to get off state or not?
Well, so I guess one way to think about it is, what starting combinatorial complexity can we deal with? And then run a calculation to get the ground state solution. So we run calculations that are as large as, roughly 10 to the 120 different rotamer sequences, and, running over the course of days to a week on a relatively large computer, we can get the ground state solution. But the ability to compute the ground state solution is a very strong function of the details of the problem.
It's a fixed backbone.
Right.
Well,
so that remains to be seen whether that sequence will in fact fold to that structure. Well, see, the great thing about dead-end elimination is that it never really, you never consider full solutions. You're only ever doing this partial calculation. And this is why a lot of people have a hard time dealing with this, is that you never consider, for example, so we're looking at some position I and its interaction energies with other positions J in the protein. but we never consider how the other J's interact with each other. So we never actually build a full solution, but we're still able to eliminate rotamers. So you never move around in the sequence space. All you're ever doing is throwing things out without ever building the full solution.
When you say ground state, you mean the lowest energy in your structure?
The lowest energy given the backbone, the rotamer library, and the potential function you're using.
But you didn't prepare the same sequence in other structures.
That's right. So this does not take into account the possibility that the sequence could fold to some alternative structure. That's the negative design problem.
When you talk about the difficulty of this calculation depends upon the exact instance of the protein or protein sequence or whatever, are there any qualitative messages that you can take away that, for instance, there are intermediate proteins, alveolar proteins?
Yeah, right. I was going to try to say that. So calculations that are easy are core calculations. So if you're just inside the protein, the constraints are big enough that it's very easy to do things that are very large combinatorial complexities and get solutions very quickly. So for example, this Springer paper that I mentioned at the very beginning, the calculations were roughly on the order of 10 to the 100th sequences, but they were all core. They were core positions. And so those calculations ran very fast, less than a day, on a medium-sized computer. For the same combinatorial complexity, if that were the surface of a beta sheet protein, that would certainly not converge. And so the core is very easy. Helical proteins in general work well, but beta sheet surfaces in particular are difficult for this algorithm to converge.
At this level of resolution, how much do you have to actually deal with the outside of the protein?
Well, if you want to design the full sequence, you have to do the full sequence, which includes the outside.
But what I mean is that I could imagine that in reality, that protein conformations would not be in a uniform on the outside of the protein. So the exact lowest energy state of those side chains may be physically irrelevant.
Right, but you still have to, I mean, at the end of the day, you still have to write down what the sequence is for the outside. And so you need to consider it. And so your first thought might be, well, the surface, polar, you should be fine. But that's actually not true. If you make a random sequence for the surface of a protein, I would guarantee you, and I know this from, we've done this ourselves, the protein won't fold. Or it'll have greatly diminished stability. And this has been, I've done this, and Tracy Handel has also done this for a couple of proteins. So the surface sequence does in fact matter, and there are in fact properties of the surface residues that could make a great deal of difference in terms of stability, even if you don't have frozen conformations for those side chains. And that's been demonstrated recently. If you look at just the global electrostatic property of the surface, there's a paper in Nature Structural Biology by Franz Schmidt recently. Last year sometime, I think, which showed that you can make mutations in the surface that optimize the electrostatic potential of the surface and get much higher stability. And there's been work similar to that on, published in JMB relatively recently as well.
Yeah, isn't it now that this is actually proven
NP complete? I'm not sure. I don't think there's actually a formal proof that says it's NP complete. But there's Niles Pierce, who was a postdoc in the lab, is an applied mathematician who's now... Right. So there's no published formal proof that says it's NP-complete, but certainly the thought is that it's NP-complete. And what I was saying is that Niles Pierce, who's an applied mathematician, is now an assistant professor at Caltech in applied math, and Eric Winfrey, who's a computer scientist at Caltech. So it's the order of the calculation is let's see, it's the n to the fifth p cubed, where n is average number of rotamers per position. And P is the number of positions. Sorry? That's right. It doesn't say whether it converges or not.
But check with his ground state. I never see something
that he's a lot.
If I did a lot of something with ground state, and then a lot.
So if it converges, it can hit the ground state.
That's right.
That's a typical number to converge.
No, this is not. This is the. This is the order of the calculation required to check whether you can eliminate something.
One step.
Right. And there's a proof in the original paper. They offer the proof is actually quite simple, but it's actually specified in the original publication. And this is the order of the calculation, not for this step, where you have a self energy and a pair energy, but it's for the step where you have a pair energy and a triple energy, and that's the slowest part of the calculation.
One thing I get is if you decide at one location that a rotamer is a best rotamer for whatever reason, you come back and recheck that it's
no. So you never check whether a rotamer is a good rotamer. You're only ever checking whether a rotamer is a bad rotamer, right? And then if you can determine whether it's a bad rotamer, if this inequality is satisfied, you throw it away.
When you have checked that one is a bad one, which one do you test next?
You just do them all.
Sure.
You do all of them.
Yeah, but they have a sequence. Does it matter?
No. Well, it probably does matter, but actually, I know it does not matter. So what happens is there's a lot more that happens with this calculation than what's shown here. So what you do is that for some state of the calculation, you have maybe 1,000 rotamers. And so you check each of those 1,000 rotamers just sequentially. You do it in parallel. And then some of those rotamers will be eliminated. And so you eliminate those rotamers, and then you apply the check again to maybe now to 900 rotamers. And you do that until you eliminate no more rotamers. So if you do that in different orders, you still end up at the same spot. So there's no dependence on the sequence in which you do the evaluations.
But what do you do with sequences? Because this step is for a fixed sequence, right? Or it includes also you are trying all.
That's right. It's for all rotamers of all the allowed amino acids at that position.
Good.
Right. Yeah. Now, so the original theorem was specifically for a fixed sequence. And so this is like a homology modeling problem. And then what we showed was that you can relax that constraint and allow rotamers from other amino acids at the position as well.
So at each position, you scan over all 20 possible amino acids
and all their rotamers, right.
So that's what the sequence actually comes in.
And that's how the sequence information comes into the calculation, right? It comes in at the level of a rotamer. And so if we're doing core positions, we allow all the rotamers for all the hydrophobic amino acids at every position in the core.
So the dead end elimination theorem, I sub R, actually is the simultaneous sum of rotamers and
yes.
amino acids.
Yes. Right. I'm sorry, I should have made that clear. But that's true. So at the end of the day, you get both the amino acid sequence and its ground state conformation.
Where do you get this pair interaction?
So these energies, so what are these energies? And that's, so these come from the potential function. And so clearly the answer you get at the end is heavily dependent on what you're putting in as the potential. Yeah, so N gets big. And I'll address this in more detail later. For boundary calculations, we're allowing essentially all the amino acids. You know, N can be on the order of hundreds. But it gets worse than that because what invariably happens in these calculations is that the you fail to converge, and there are tricks that you can play in order to invoke higher orders of the equation. And the common trick is to take two positions, two residue positions, and merge them together. And so now when if I have a merged position, when I do the single doubles, that really looks like, you know, a double triple. And so when you merge positions together, you greatly blow up the number of rotamers. And so that number n can get to be thousands of rotamers, and which makes the calculation run very slowly. But it's a great excuse to try to get money to buy a big computer. Okay, let me just skip that. So here, just graphically, what happens in this equation. So these are all possible configurations. This is the energy just with respect to some residue position I, and we're asking about some rotamer R at I. And what dead elimination says is that if these two energy surfaces don't cross, then I can throw R away, and that's just obvious, right? No matter where the global solution is here, T is always a better choice. Doesn't mean T is a ground state, but it just means that T is a better choice than R. And the question is, well, how do I know that T is always a better choice? What the equation is doing is it's just evaluating this to see if it's greater than zero, which effectively means it's just looking for the point of closest approach of these two surfaces. And so if the difference is zero, then you can throw R away. If the curves cross, and the minimum difference will end up being negative, and so you cannot throw R away. Even though maybe the global solution is over here, but you can't know that. And so some of the mathematical tricks that have recently been employed in a paper that we published last year in JCOM-CHEM is a way to further divide this configuration space so that you can ask about different segments in a way which makes the calculation run much faster, orders of magnitude faster. Okay, so the potential function, this is reviewed in a paper that we published a couple of years ago. And this is just a summary of the potential function that we're currently using. So we use a simple Lennard-Jones 12-6 van der Waals potential with van der Waals radii that are scaled by 90%, by 0.9, scaled down by 10%. And this scaling, so we use normal radii, and then make them a little bit smaller as a way to soften the bad effects of having a fixed backbone and fixed sidechain rotamers. So if you use smaller atoms, it makes it look as if you're allowing some isotropic variation in the protein backbone and in the sidechain positions. And we use, and this is important, we use an atomic solvation potential that is computed by looking at buried hydrophobic surface area. The value of that potential is 48 calories per mole per square angstrom of buried hydrophobic surface area. This number is slightly larger than the number you would get if you ask someone what's sigma and P. Most people would say, well, it's around 25. And so our number is slightly larger because we have this has to be in the context of the way we calculate all the other energies in the system. It just turns out that a number twice as big as what people would normally expect works well for our case in our design calculations. Now, as a way to start to address issues of negative design, our solvation potential also includes a penalty for residual hydrophobic exposure. And the rationale there is, so there's some work that and Eugene can correct me if I get the wrong citation. I think Ken Dill has a paper based on lattice model simulations where he showed that that one way to address negative design is to minimize the amount of hydrophobic exposure you have in your target structure. And that kind of makes sense intuitively, right? If we have, for our target fold, if we have a lot of hydrophobic exposure, there are two things that could happen that are bad. One is that we can get the wrong oligomerization state. It could dimerize or aggregate and precipitate. Or because of the excess hydrophobic exposure, the thermodynamic desire will be to try to bury that, and it may try to find some other structure which buries all that hydrophobic surface area. So if we try to minimize the amount of hydrophobic exposure on our target structure, that is effectively a cheap way to start to build in issues of negative design.
But you mentioned before that hydrophobic, this kind of term is not too particle decomposable.
That's right. So there are ways you can actually approximate surface area burial by using a sum of two body interactions. And so we have a paper several years ago in, I think it's in Folding and Design with Arthur Street. And it's a kind of a simple thing. So if you just take a collection of spheres in a cubic, I can't remember what the lattice type is, but some type of cubic lattice, you can calculate analytically, it's a very simple equation that you can derive, what happens if you take you try to do surface area burial by a sum of two body interactions, you end up overcounting burial and undercounting exposure. And so for a simple system of like a cubic close packed lattice, you can analytically write down an expression that tells you exactly how much overcounting you're going to get. And the number is, I forget, it's roughly, 40% or something like that. And so what we do is then we don't use the analytical expression because it's for a perfectly dense system. And so what we did was we went to a database of structures and then just fit that parameter in order to minimize the error that you would get by doing the two-body summation. And it works reasonably well, but it's not perfect. So there is definitely error that we're getting by our inability to exactly compute how much burial we have and how much exposure we're going to have.
So why do you want to make it two bodies?
It's really an n-body term because you need to know where everything else is in order to figure out how much buried surface area you have. But see that, but in dead elimination, we never build the configurations. Right. So it's really our desire to use dead end elimination that requires us to have the two body method here. So if, for example, we wanted to do it by a Monte Carlo simulation, we could build the entire structure for some rotamer configuration, some sequence in rotamer configuration, evaluate the true buried area, the true exposed area, and compute its energy, and then do a Monte Carlo move and do the same thing over again. That would be incredibly slow, because you'd have to build the structure and evaluate it, right. Now, but in our calculation, using dead elimination, you never build a structure. You evaluate all these pairwise energies up front, and that's just it's an n squared problem, so it's trivial. And then you save that energy matrix, and you just kind of you have a lookup table as you evaluate that expression. So it's very fast in that respect. But it requires this two-body approximation for surface area. We use an explicit hydrogen bond term. It's a kind of the old charm amber 12-10 potential with an 8 kcal well depth, and we also use a 2 kcal per mole penalty for burying uncompensated polar hydrogens. So that is, if you bury a lysine, you don't make a hydrogen bond to its hydrogens, you get penalized. So you could also do that by having a polar burial penalty term up here as well, and we can do it either way. Now, the reason we use an explicit hydrogen bond potential is that our Coulombic potential is heavily damped. So most modern force fields would not have an explicit H-bond potential. They would capture all the hydrogen bonding effects by using their standard Coulomb's law electrostatic potential. Now we've elected not to do it that way, primarily because the size of the partial atomic charges that are required to get good hydrogen bonding interactions are relatively large, that causes other problems in the calculation. And because it's clear that a simple Coulomb's law potential doesn't work very well for proteins because you really, you have this dielectric discontinuity between the solvent and the protein. So it seems not good or bizarre to use a kind of a, you know, Coulomb's law potential with big partial atomic charges. You're going to get energies that the electrostatic energy is going to dominate everything else, and that's the term that you clearly know is wrong. And so what we've done instead is to use an explicit H-bond potential and small partial atomic charges with a distance-dependent dielectric constant. So we use a dielectric of 40 that is also distance-dependent. So as you get further away, the value of the dielectric gets larger. So you get this damping effect.
The 8 kcal per mole is odds
more than... It's, most people would think this is a big number.
Yeah.
You know, if, experimentally, if you look at the, you know, a strong hydrogen bond in a protein, you know, it might be 1 to 2 kcal per mole. But again, you know, these numbers are designed to be self-consistent. And so we would never argue that the value of the energy you get out of the calculation has anything to do with the real experimental stability number. And also, in general, you're never going to get the full 8 kcal because this is... in order to get the 8 kcal, you have to be at the exactly the right distance. And in our case, we're using 2.8 angstroms as the optimal H-bond distance, and you have to have exactly the right angle, 180 degrees. So this potential has, you know, it has like a, you know, it's a simple kind of Lenard-Jones looking potential, but it's 12.10 instead of 12.6, and it also has a cosine term on the end, a cosine of the fourth term. So As you deviate from linearity, the value that you get, the energy you get, drops off very, very rapidly. So this is for perfect. In most cases, you're getting much less than that. But it is a large number. Okay. This is, some of these things are talked about in more detail in that review. All right. So does this work? So let me tell you about this one result, which was published several years ago now, and then some newer stuff. And depending on the time, I might skip some things and get to the the enzyme design part, which I think is the neatest stuff that we have so far. Okay, so here's a test case. So the holy grail in the computational protein design field is to take some target fold, strip off all the side chains, push a button in your program to compute a new sequence, and then to show experimentally that it actually folds to the right structure. And this was the first case where that actually has been done. So the target fold is with just some small protein, a zinc finger fold, the 28 amino acid fragment of a Drosophila or of a transcription factor called ZIP268. That's really not important. And like all zinc finger folds, it requires a metal ion in order to fold properly. So what we wanted to do was to strip up all the side chains, take the crystallographic backbone, run this design calculation, and compute a new sequence, make the molecule, and see whether it folds properly, and solve its structure using NMR techniques. So here's our computed sequence on top, FSD1 for full sequence design 1. Given our partitioning of core, surface, and boundary, the sequence diversity allowed in the calculation is on the order of 10 to the 27 possible sequences, but obviously the calculation is larger than that because we're doing the calculation in Rotamer space. And I like to always point this out that this is a great case of, you know, you can't do this experimentally. If you wanted to build an experimental combinatorial library where you had just a single example of each of the 10 to 27 possible sequences, it would require more than 11 metric tons of pure peptide. Which I think you could convince no graduate student to make. Okay, so it's no. Oh, so no. You leave the metal ion in; it's cheating because the folding energy is dominated by metal binding.
Okay, it's the design that doesn't require metal ion.
That's right. So we're looking at things that do not bind metal and do not have disulfide bonds. Mm-hmm. So it's going to fold purely based on hydrophobic burial and getting, you know, good salt bridges and things like that. Computationally, this is an old. This would run very much faster now because of the improvements. 90 hours. It was run on 10 processor computers, so it only took like 10 hours. And if you eyeball the sequences, you can see they're quite different. 21% identical, so the twilight zone of sequence identity. If you do a blast search of the sequence, the design sequence, you could hit this as high as 39%, but the p-values suggest that the hits are statistically insignificant. Okay, so this is a 28 mer, trivial to make on a peptide synthesizer. We made it. It folds. It has a melting temperature of roughly 40 degrees C. And if you solve the structure using NMR, you get the following result. In red is the backbone trace of the target. And in blue is the experimentally determined backbone trace of the design sequence. So it matches actually quite well. So this was, I think, a clear demonstration that you can do these sort of calculations, that the potential functions are not perfect, but good enough to give you sequences that actually do fold to the target structure. Okay.
If you have to go more for less than 30 minutes to go, if you have about 30 minutes to make it better.
Well, maybe we should have a break then.
Okay.
All right. So is this being recorded?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, you just missed 10 minutes. Okay, so we're going to cheat here and do. Okay. We're going to do a composition bias to just ask the question whether it matters. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to run a series of calculations, We already ran the zero bias, or this is N and C terminal bias. One NC means we're going to bias the composition for the N terminal most and the C terminal most position. Three NC means we're going to bias the composition for the three N terminal and the three C terminal positions. And then three NC N cap means we're also going to add a composition bias for the capping position. And we just do that by restricting the amino acids that we can allow at those positions. So for normal surface positions, we allow these 10 amino acids. For the N-terminal positions, because of the partial positive charge, we disallow the three residues that have positive charge. For the C-terminal positions, because of the partial negative charge, we disallow the residues that have negative charge, aspen glue. And for the capping positions, we allow those four residues that have high statistical propensity based on a database survey to appear in capping positions. All right. Right, so if you do a database survey, yeah. And this is not our work, this is, there are lots of publications like this. One of them that we used was by George Rose. I can't remember who the other authors were. But basically, they went to a database and they looked at a database of structures and they looked at the statistical preference to find certain amino acids at the N capping position, at C capping position, which I'm not showing you, and at various positions along the alpha helix. And you get the kind of expected bias. The four highest things at N capping positions are those four small side chains that can accept the hydrogen bond. All right, so ignore all of this except for the last one. So this is a fully biased calculation, and so there are no violations of helix dipole rules or helix capping rules. So we make all those molecules. They're all folded. This is just a far UVCD spectrum. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly, but happily, the sequences that have this composition bias do, in fact, show dramatically increased thermal stability. Here's just summarized. So wild type is 43. Our unbiased calculation is the same as wild type. Our fully biased calculation is a 23-fold butane from wild type and gains 30 degrees C in thermal stability. So it's pretty significant.
So wild type doesn't care here.
Wild type, if you look at it has violations of helix dipole rules, but all the capping positions are satisfied. But 43 degrees C, this is a Drosophila protein, and Drosophila, I think, grow optimally at 26 degrees C. So this is plenty stable for what it needs. But in terms of just optimal sequences and stability, you can get much better. And also, we're not constraining here for function, whereas obviously the wild-type protein has to constrain its sequence in order to maintain its biological function. And in our case, we're not doing that.
Could you have designed the sequence of the, like what Michael Peck did, for example, for each helix, you just have binary patterns, random binary patterns?
You could do that. And Michael got a lot of positive press on that result. Now, the it's interesting to note that you've never seen a structure of any of those molecules, and the reason is they're all molten globules. So it's clear that you can use a simple binary pattern method and random sequences that match that random sequences that match that pattern and get things that fold the molten globules. But in my opinion, a molten globule result is a negative result, because naturally occurring proteins are not molten globules.
Why, in your previous question, the major improvement comes on mutation between valency and fluency?
Right, yes.
Can you explain that?
So we're actually going back now, and
and nothing else happens further on, and nothing happened before.
So right, so there are, I forget now in the details, but I guess I don't have the numbers here. If you look at, the question is, how many violations do you have? So by the time you get to 2NC, I think you're removing most of the violations. But we're actually going back now, making just point mutations to figure out where we get the stability increase.
Violations are unsatisfied. How did you
run? The violations are, if I put a positive charge at the N-terminus, that's a violation, or a negative charge at the C-terminus is a violation, or a non-capping residue at the capping position. And what I should have had here was a list of how many violations there are and what the nature of the violation is. But yeah, this is something we're exploring. You know, why do we get most of the stability here? Okay, interesting tidbit on computational time. The unbiased calculation, 10 to 29 sequences corresponding to 10 to 67 rotamers, took 88 hours. The biased calculation, even though the combinatorial complexity is essentially the same, the total compute time goes down by an order of magnitude. That just goes back to this issue, the stiff order dependence on the average number of rotamers per position. Because when we add the bias, we're removing arginine and glue and lyse, which are the three polar amino acids that have the highest number of rotamers. So we reduce the average number, and we get a good computational effect. Okay, so the take home really is that if in fact we can optimize, if we can create a force field, so it seems clear that based on that result, that helix dipole and capping interactions can be used to increase protein stability. So the real question now is, how do we capture that in a force field that allows us to do that without having to apply these silly compositional biases?
One question. A couple of days ago, David Baker was talking about his work, which is superficially somewhat similar in terms of taking a sequence and looking at all of the ways you could pack that. And what he gets is that, in general, you end up with a sequence that's very close to wild type, while you get a sequence that's far from wild type. Is it just a difference in the potential?
What David may have forgot to tell you is that he has tuned his force field so that you do get sequences that are close to wild type. So, and how he's done that is, when he was tuning his force field, he had a set of 100 structures and 100 sequences that match those structures. And then he had some force field that he was using, and then he introduces a scalar term, 20 values, one for each amino acid, and he adjusts that value such that, when he runs his sequence calculation, he gets the highest possible match to the sequences on the target 100 molecules. So his force field is explicitly biased to give you sequences that look native-like. So I was always a little bit, that's published work, and that, you know, it's a little bit, I mean, it's interesting and good stuff, but it's kind of circular, right? Because, let me bias my force field to get native-like sequences, then I run some calculations, I make the statement, well, I get native-like sequences. And so, you know, it's a little bit, you have to think about that a little bit. And we're not doing anything that, except for what I just showed you, our normal force field does not have compositional biases. John Desjarlais, who's also doing this sort of work, he also explicitly includes a scalar term that tries to give him sequence compositions that look wild type. And we're not doing that. We think it's, and what are you learning by that? You know, the real objective here is to end up with a force field that really captures the thermodynamics. And so if you're now putting in these kind of bogus terms to give you something that looks good, that's, I think, a little bit, I think it misses the objective. Okay, so the binary patterning thing. All right, so because we're using gradient elimination, we have this fifth order dependence on the average number of row elements per position. And the boundary positions are the most problematic because we're allowing both hydrophobic and polar amino acids. So we have a large number of row elements there. And what we'd like to be able to do is to force a complete binary pattern on our target structure in order to both reduce the time constraints of the calculation and possibly to address this issue of negative design. So Eugene has at least one paper where this issue of, now correct me if I'm wrong, the idea of using a random energy model as a way to end up getting a sequence which folds your target structure as opposed to folding to some alternative fold. And in the manifestation that Eugene had, it was a one way to get that was to have a fixed composition for your sequence. So, 20 polars and 15 hydrophobics. And then you just randomize them. And if you actually have a fixed composition and you then design for the ground state or design for some target fold, you have a higher probability of getting that sequence to fold to that target. So another way to think about that, an extension would be, well, rather than having a fixed specific sequence composition, 3 alanines, 5 trips, whatever, to have a fixed binary pattern. So at low resolution, a fixed binary pattern looks like fixed amino acid composition. Because, in the unfolded state, so it's really a question, what's the unfolded state look like? And so all the hydrophobes kind of look the same, all the polars kind of look the same. So if I can impose a fixed binary pattern on my structure and design a sequence to that fixed binary pattern, then I should be able to invoke the random energy model and say I've treated negative design in some direct way. So there's that objective in here as well. Okay, so let me tell you very quickly how we classify currently to give core boundary surface, a new method that allows us to get a strict binary pattern everywhere, and I'll show you some experimental results against that. So we have to calibrate this new method, and we set it up so it has a single adjustable parameter, and as is typical in my lab, we set parameters by making molecules and seeing which ones are the best as a way to set a value of a parameter. So the old way to this classification, it goes as follows. We have some protein. Now, of course, this has to be sequence independent, right? You could trivially think, well, if I know the sequence, I know the pattern because I can just classify amino acids as polar or nonpolar. But I'm doing design, so I don't know the sequence, so I have to come up with a method which is sequence independent. In this method, we take the C alpha positions. Here's a 3 helical bimodal protein as an example. Take the C alpha positions. We compute a Conley surface using a probe radius of 8 angstroms. And that gives us kind of a low resolution envelope around the protein. We have C betas in our design. We know where the C betas are because we can model them in. And so we compute, there are two numbers that we're computing. One is this projection, this distance from C alpha along C beta to the surface. And the second number, D2, is the distance from C beta to the surface. And we just say surface residues are those residues that have D1 plus D2 less than 2.7 angstroms. It's kind of obvious, right? If I'm here, it's going to be close, so it's going to be a surface position. Core residues have a long D1, but also a D2 greater than 2 angstroms. So, for example, here, the D1 would be long, and the D2 would also be long. So this would be a core position. And everything else is boundary. So if a small globular protein, you typically get 60% surface, 20% core, and 20% boundary. And for calculations, it's a 20% boundary that's a real problem. Okay, so the new method is, sequence independent. What we do is we take some backbone, we strip off any side chains that we might know about, and we build some generic side chain on it that looks like the average amino acid in terms of size and shape. We then compute the exposure of each of these side chains. So this is as a function of residue number. This is the amount of solvent exposed surface area. core positions are going to have low exposure, surface is going to have high. So for each position, we can, you know, write down the exposure, and then we can just ask the question, what is the cutoff parameter that separates buried hydrophobic things from polar exposed things? All right. Ken Dill has a method which is, you know, addresses this issue as well, which is, you know, similar but different. Question is then, we need to figure out what this cutoff parameter is. Now, one way you could do it is go to a database and do a database survey, and you'll get a number, and we've done that. And I won't tell you what the number is. Another way to do it is to actually make some molecules and experimentally assess their stabilities and their fold specificities. All right, so this is the same Engrail protein that I showed you before for the surface optimization. As a background here, we're going to use a 29-fold mutant, which is a core surface-optimized design, which I didn't tell you about. And then now there are 11 boundary positions. And so now we're going to classify each of these 11 boundary positions as either polar or nonpolar based on this cutoff parameter. So we're going to have, yeah, so here, so this is the most buried position, this is the most exposed position, and we're going to do designs for the cutoff being at various places along this exposure metric. So with the generic side chain here, there are exposures in square angstroms, and as a function of residue numbers, the red numbers, the red dots, are the positions that were previously classified as core. The blue ones are those that were previously classified as surface. It's the green positions with the numbers that we're worried about. And the question is, you know, where do we put this cutoff to partition the green set into red and into blue? All right, so then we have 10 different binary patterns. Because we allow alanine to be both hydrophobic and polar, the pattern B5 is identical, so we leave it out. Okay, so then for each fixed binary pattern for the boundary, we're going to run our normal sequence calculation. So for pattern B1, where we have one nonpolar and the rest are polar, pattern B10 has 10 nonpolars and one polar. So for each fixed binary pattern, we're going to compute a sequence, and here are all the sequences. Here's the wild type, and here's some other thing. All right, they're all folded. We made all the molecules using standard methods. They're all folded. They're interestingly very stable. So sequences corresponding to patterns B2 through B7 have melting temperatures greater than 99 degrees C. Remember now, the wild type was like 45 degrees C. So they're hyperthermophilic. Pattern B1 is less stable than wild type. So in order to get a better assessment of the stability of B2 through B7, we did chemical denaturation. The data are shown here. The stabilities are actually pretty large. And so you might think, well pattern B7 is the best. Patterns B8, B9, and B10 led to aggregated protein, as you might expect. If you put too much hydrophobic in, it's going to aggregate. So we increase the hydrophobic nature, and we get increasingly higher stability. But if you look at fold specificity, there are two issues here. One is, what is the aggregation state of the molecule? These should be monomers. And the other issue is, if I look at chemical shift dispersion in an NMR experiment, are they molten globules? So here's whether they're aggregates or not. Here's the pattern number B1, 2, 3, et cetera. This is the percent monomer in blue and percent aggregate in red. And you can see that up to B6, we're essentially 100% monomer. As we add more hydrophobic positions, we drop down and we build up lots of aggregate. So based on the combination of stability and an assessment of fold specificity, I'm not going to show you the NMR data, but it also corroborates this, we would select pattern B6 as being the pattern which is has good stability and good fold specificity. Okay, so the cutoff then is 42 square angstroms. So what if we do the database survey? So if I go to a database of structures, I do the same sort of deal, and I ask, what is the cutoff that actually gives me the best match to the binary pattern of the sequence in the database? You get a number which is roughly half this, which is interesting. So interesting in two respects. One is that experimentally, if you optimize this parameter, you get a larger value, suggesting that design sequences can in fact get away with being much more hydrophobic as a way to get higher stability. Now, the other interesting aspect is that if you look at naturally occurring sequences, they tend to be more polar than optimal. And one argument is that they don't need to be maximally stable because, you know, if you're not a hyperthermophilic organism, you don't need to have your proteins with a melting temperature greater than 100 degrees C. The other issue is that if we look at, as we go to more hydrophobic patterns, as we go from B6 to B7, we're starting to build up a significant amount of aggregate. So even though B6 is optimal by the criteria of stability and fold specificity, it's really only a point mutation away from a molecule that has a high tendency to aggregate. And so biologically, that's going to be really bad. So perhaps you want to have a binary pattern which is shifted more polar in order to minimize your propensity to aggregate.
So if you select it for functionality, you get pretty close to wild type?
Well, I would say that if we were more concerned with aggregation behavior, we would probably tend towards more polar sequences.
About the B6, are you sure that it's not multiple globules?
I don't have the NMR data here, but if you look at the NMR spectra, it's clearly well dispersed and has native-like properties, whereas the other ones tend to look like molten globules.
Right. The other one, which is four fluid.
All the way up to B6, the NMR spectra look as you would expect. They look like native proteins. Beyond B6, they start to degrade. And by the time you're at, B10, it's an aggregated mess, so the NMR spectra look terrible.
Is it cut off different in thermophiles?
So we haven't done that. That would be interesting. We haven't done that. Okay, so we can use this method to get a full binary pattern. And the interesting thing is, especially as it relates to this idea of the random energy model and as a way to get fold specificity, the selection of the optimal binary pattern maximizes both stability and specificity of the design sequence for the target fold. So I think it's another interesting way to maybe build in ideas of negative design without actually having to go consider specifically alternative folds. Okay, so in the last 10 minutes, let me tell you about the newest stuff. The last result is published. It just came out in JNB, I think, last month. So the thing that we're really interested in ultimately is designing functional proteins, in particular designing enzymes. And so what we want to be able to do is come up with a computational analog to catalytic antibody design. And for those of you who don't know what catalytic antibody design is, let me just review for you quickly. So the catalytic antibody methodology was developed. There are three people that are typically credited for it. Lerner at Scripps, Peter Schultz, now at Scripps also, and Steve Benkovic at Penn State. And the idea was that if I want to design a protein that catalyzes some chemical transformation, I need to do two things. One is to chemically synthesize an analog of the transition state of the reaction of interest. And then generate and screen a library of antibodies that bind to that transition state haptin. If I can pull out an antibody that binds to this transition state analog, then that molecule should, in theory, catalyze the reaction by lowering the energy of the transition state, kind of classic Pauling, transition state stuff. So the difficulty with catalytic antibody design is that, A, you have to chemically synthesize a transition state analog. So unless you're Peter Schultz, you really can't do this, because it's hard. We want to get rid of that. Instead of chemically synthesizing a transition state analog, we want to model the transition state computationally. So that's hard experimentally, but I think tractable computationally. Second thing that's hard about catalytic antibody design is that you have to find an antibody to bind to this thing. So you've got to generate antibodies. It's a real pain in the butt. It's very difficult. So we don't want to do that. We want to take our computational model of transition state and use it to compute a sequence which will stabilize it on some target fold. Third thing about catalytic antibodies that's bad is that you can only do it with an antibody fold because you're generating antibodies using the immune system. So you cannot do this in some in vitro method. And so we want to be able to get around that requirement of using the antibody fold. We want to be able to computationally use any fold so that ultimately we can look at issues of the evolvability of function given some target fold. All right, so the test reaction is a simple reaction. It's the hydrolysis of an activated ester, very similar to the first chalic antibodies. First chalic antibodies were carbonate and ester hydrolases. So a very similar reaction. We're going to take the thyrodoxin fold, and I'm going to show you some results. All right. So here's the substrate, perinitrile phenylacetate. We're going to break this bond using a nucleophile. In chalic antibody design, you really cannot specify the mechanism by which the chemistry will occur. All you're doing is building a transition state model and looking for a protein that will bind stably to it. Here, we're going to not only specify the transition state, we're also going to specify the exact chemical mechanism. So you have two choices for hydrolysis, nucleophilic hydrolysis, which is what we select, and you also have the option of doing acid-base hydrolysis, where you, for example, you protonate the carbonyl oxygen and then attack with water. Okay, so we're going to do nucleophilic hydrolysis. We get some transition state with partial charge separation. We get a high energy state, which has full charge separation, which then collapses, releasing perinitrile phenol. And importantly, from a mechanistic point of view, we should generate an acylated enzyme intermediate, which in a second step should hydrolyze to release acetate and regenerate the nucleophile, regenerate the enzyme.
So you only worry about the transition state of the substrate as opposed to the enzyme itself?
Well, the transition state has the enzyme in it. So this nucleophile, this is the enzyme.
But you're not worried about the conformations far away from the enzyme site?
Well, so ideally you worry about the whole protein. So when I stick the transition state model in there, I want the entire protein sequence to respond to the presence of this species.
So in that case, I don't understand how you can ensure that you have a sort of unique transition state.
Well, so what I'm doing is really literally the computational analog to chalic antibody design. I'm building a model of the transition state for the reaction of interest, and then I'm going to compute a sequence which stabilizes this, assuming that, which is not a great assumption, but assuming that most of catalysis is transition state stabilization, which is not necessarily true. Okay, so here's the reaction. Uncatalyzed, high activation barrier. We build an enzyme. We get the substrate. We form the Michaelis complex. Go to the transition state, generate a high energy intermediate, which collapses to release first product, perinitrile phenol, generates an acylated enzyme intermediate, which then subsequently hydrolyzes, regenerate the enzyme. Okay, so how do we do this? We're going to choose the model of the high energy state as opposed to the true transition state. They're very similar, it's just easier to do the high energy intermediate. And we do that by selecting a nucleophile. We select histidine, and we build rotamers of this high energy intermediate with histidine attached to it. So we have two choices for the nucleophilic nitrogen, and we considered both. Here I'm just showing one. And we also have two choices for attack on the carbonyl, right? These are different enantiotopic faces. So we build all those configurations. And then we use rotamers for chi1 and chi2 that just match our database, our normal rotamers, and we build canonical values for chi3, 4, and 5. And then in the calculation, what we're going to do is we're going to, there are 108 residues. We're going to look at all 94 non-glycine, non-proline positions, and we're going to run 94 different calculations. So in the first calculation, we're going to stick our activated complex at position 1, and ask the question, what are the mutations required everywhere else to bind that transition state model? Then do that calculation for putting it, the histidine at position 2, et cetera, for all 94 non-glycine, non-proline positions. All right, so this is, as you would imagine, would be a big calculation if we allowed full sequence design everywhere else, but we make it simple by only allowing mutation to either between wild type or alanine. So we have two choices at every position outside of the position where we put the catalytic residue. But that's still a big calculation. It's roughly 10 to the 28 sequence combinations per calculation. That took 2 days on 14 processors. So we call this kind of this is like a low-resolution scan. This is basically identifying the positions in the protein where the active site must go, and we build in mutations to alanine in order to accommodate the presence, the steric bulk of the substrate. Then we can go back in subsequent calculations, and all the positions that changed to alanine, we can then repack with full amino acid diversity. So the results I'll show you today are based simply on this alanine scanning approach. So a very, very low resolution active site, but I think the results are still interesting. I'm sorry.
The position of these active sites somehow relative to the protein, or just to all the proteins to look for the active site?
So we did, we considered the active site, we essentially allowed the active site to be anywhere in the protein. And the way we do that is by running, 94 separate calculations where the active site residue is in a different position. So we scan it through the entire protein, but in separate calculations. So then we have 94 results. We have to rank them somehow. We throw out all the results where the substrate is completely sequestered inside the protein, where it would be inaccessible to solving. So they're thrown away. And then we rank order the remaining ones by hydrophobic burial of the substrate.
What is the length of the substrate?
Sorry?
The length of the enzyme, why 94 residues of the enzyme?
Well, so it's 108 residue protein, and we chose the 94 non-glycine, non-proline positions. No, so I'll show you the data in a second. The thyrodoxin has no activity, essentially no activity for this reaction. So it's a globular protein that just is used for something else. No active site. It's a redox protein. It has a disulfide bond that's used to donate electrons in some redox cycle. So it doesn't have an active site, and you'll see that in a second. Okay, so the rest of the designs are ranked by fraction hydrophobic exposure. The idea is that if we're touching a lot of the substrate, we'll probably get better binding and better catalysis. So there are two that are clearly best. There's one that exposes only 11%, one that exposes 15%, and then it jumps up to 30% and continues. And interestingly, there's a wild type, and a number of mutations to make the active site. There's a wild type histidine in position 6, which requires no mutations. But it has, 36% exposure, suggesting that really it's not recognizing the substrate. We made PZD stands for Prodesign Design 1 and 2. I'll talk just about number 2. It puts the catalytic histidine in position 17. It requires a total of 3 mutations, one to put it in catalytic histidine, a leucine to his, and then 2 additional mutations to alanine to accommodate the substrate, a phi to alanine and a tyrosine alanine. This is a computational model of what it looks like. So here's the catalytic histidine coming off of a loop, and here's the substrate. And then in a space filling, you can see that we've created a fairly substantial active site cleft on the surface. Where here's the kind of the methyl group down in here, and the paradoxal phenol is behind the lysine. All right. Again, this is just computational models, not experimental. Just in more detail, you can see that we have a deep cleft here. Here's the wild-type surface in this region, and you can clearly see there's not a cleft there. Here are the residues on the wild-type surface that are going to be mutated. The histidine gets introduced here, and then the paradoxal phenol is going to lie in the groove created by mutating this tyrosine and phenylalanine to alanine. Okay, experimentally, you can make the molecule straightforward PCR mutagenesis. The first interesting result was that it shows saturation kinetics as you would expect for an enzyme. So for if you just put histidine in solution, it will also catalyze the reaction, but it will do it in a bimolecular way, and you will not get a binding event. An enzyme will bind substrate, and at high substrate concentration, the velocity of the reaction will maximize, because you're occupying all the active sites. So the saturation kinetics is characteristic of a binding event, suggesting that the molecule is in fact binding, and the chemistry is occurring as you would expect. Here's a kinetic model, standard Michaelis-Menten kinetics. If you fit the data, we get a Km of 170 micromolar, which is actually not horrible, but you know it could easily be improved. And again, remember, this is a low-resolution active site where we've just gone to alanine and not to other amino acids. The K-cat over K-uncat is roughly 200, so we get two orders of magnitude of rate acceleration. Again, you know, that's not great, but you know, for a proto-enzyme, that's actually not too bad. Real enzymes have rate accelerations, you know, 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 6th, and beyond. The first catalytic antibodies have rate accelerations of roughly 10 to the 3rd, so we're in the ballpark of the first catalytic antibodies by a simple computational design method. Now, the mechanism is important here because we've designed this as nucleophilic catalysis, so we should be able to see the characteristics of that kind of catalysis. And one of them would be the observation of a burst phase. So at high substrate concentration, when you mix the solutions, you're going to saturate the active site, and you're going to get an initial burst of enzymatic activity as you turn over the substrate. So we see the classic characteristic burst phase, and then at steady state, we achieve some steady state rate of turnover. So we have a linear phase. So this pre-steady state experiment clearly shows the expected characteristic burst followed by a steady state turnover for the enzyme. We look at wild-type protein. Wild-type are the black triangles, essentially no catalytic activity. If we take our design molecule, which has three mutations, and we mutate out the histidine, so we remove the nucleophile, it turns the enzyme off. If we leave the histidine in and mutate the other two active site residues back to the wild-type, it also turns the mutation, it turns the activity off. So we require all three mutations in order to see the desired activity. And one last thing on the on the mechanism. Now, because this enzyme is actually relatively slow, that is the half-life of the acylate enzyme intermediate should be relatively long, we should be able to trap it by mass spec. And here's that experiment. So here's the enzyme in panel A. This is just parent protein by itself. We also get a plus 63 it's a copper adduct. Thyrodoxin is known to bind copper kind of spuriously. So we get the parent protein plus parent protein and copper. If we add the substrate and then quench the reaction, we see clearly a huge increase in a plus 42 species, which is the mass of acylation. So clearly we're getting that intermediate. We're also getting the acylated protein plus copper. So that you can explain all these peaks. We take the crippled enzyme where we remove the catalytic histidine. Here's its spectrum, looks the same. As substrate, we get basically background for acylation. So clearly we're having, because of the saturation kinetics, the observation of the burst phase in the pre-steady state experiment, and the observation of the plus 42 species in mass spec, it's clearly following the design reaction, or the design mechanism. So not only do we get activity by the mechanism that we designed. It can also be inhibited. So if we throw in a non-hydrolyzable substrate shown here, we get classic competitive inhibition, suggesting that the inhibitor binds at the same active site. The inhibition constant is terrible, but you know it's not that bad, 20 millimolar. All right, again, just comparing to the first catalytic antibodies, this should be PZD2. We get a rate acceleration of roughly 200. The first catalytic antibodies were roughly 10 to the third, so we're off by an order of magnitude, but that, you know, we're in the ballpark. In terms of the Km, we're definitely in the ballpark of what the first catalytic antibodies were. And this is, again, for a soft active site. We're now in the process of now fully elaborating the active site with the idea of getting better Km, which should ultimately give us better catalytic performance. And one last thing I'd like to say is that this is interesting because it now allows us to directly address issues of evolvability of protein function, and also to address issues of the relationship or the compatibility of different fold classes for different types of chemistry. So, for example, if you look at all naturally occurring enzymes, roughly 15% of them use the Tim Beryl fold. Is that just a fluke of evolution, or is it because the Tim Beryl fold is inherently, from a chemical physics point of view, better able to evolve function? So what we can do now is to look at for some target reaction, look at different fold classes, design, you know, nascent enzymes, proto-enzymes, and then using, you know, standard in vitro evolution methodologies, evolve each of those independently and make an assessment as to how well they're able to evolve high performance enzymes. So we think this is a way to really study this idea of the evolvability of different protein folds for different types of chemical functionality. And then just to acknowledge people, so I showed publications where things were published, and the other stuff was done by Chantal Morgan, who is a chemistry graduate student, surface optimization stuff. Binary pattern work was done by Shannon Marshall. That's been published very recently in JMB. The calic design work has been done by Dan Bolin, who's a biochem student. And funding, and particularly I'd like to acknowledge the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation. And for those of you who live in California, you'll recognize the Parsons Foundation as the people who sponsor Huell Hauser, California's gold. No. Anyway, we recently got a $2 million grant from them to buy computer hardware, and we currently have in the lab a 128 processor IBM SP3, and we're looking to build it bigger. Okay, so I'll stop there.